It's estimated that 30% of all Western Buddhists are Jews, and that a large percentage also of gurus are Jewish people as well. There's even a term, I'm sure you've heard of Jew-boos. There's an extraordinary attraction to Buddhism in general today, and in particular, many young Jewish people as well. And there's all sorts of stories. Some of them are probably myth, but I'm sure some of them are true, of Jewish people going to ashrams and other places and meeting other Jews there. And you should know that at any given time, this is probably not because of Buddhism, but because it's a cheap place to vacation. Probably the number one site for Israelis following the army to travel is India, and a lot of them go to where the Dalai Lama is, or Nepal, or other very beautiful parts of the countries. Travel the Himalayas. I'm not saying they're all going because of looking for spiritual enlightenment, but a lot of them are going, and end up getting very connected to the whole thing, and missing the whole spiritual connection of Kabbalah and mysticism that exists in their own religion. And in fact, famous story that's attributed to the Dalai Lama, who was addressing a group of students, and when he was asking everybody where they were from, and one of them mentioned he was Israeli, he had just finished the army, he said, "What are you doing here? Go back to Israel and study your tradition, because there's so much spirituality there. You don't need this." But what I wanted to do tonight is actually share with you something about Judaism, because I'm not an expert in Buddhism. I'm learning right now from my 17-year-old son, who's reading a great book authored by Akiva Tatz called Letters from a Buddhist, which is a wonderful book. If anyone's read any of Akiva Tatz's books, he's a physician, he's a brilliant scholar in Jewish philosophy, and he's answering questions of someone who became a very, very serious Buddhist, trying to explain the Jewish approach to some of the issues that Buddhism takes on. But I think it actually sometimes escapes the issue when we talk about, well, Judaism's got spirituality too. The question is, what's the difference between the Jewish approach to spirituality, and I don't just mean Buddhist approach to spirituality, but really more the Near Eastern religions. And next time we meet, which is not next Monday night, I think it's in two Monday nights, we're going to talk about the difference between Judaism and Christianity. Which is easier to spell out. But I have some interesting comments on that, a little more developed, actually, than tonight. But what really is the difference between Jewish spirituality and the Near Eastern concept of spirituality? And I spoke about it on Shabbat, and I want to make reference to some of the things that I said then. First of all, I mentioned that just last week, literally a week ago, Cameron Diaz got married to a guy by the name of Benji Madden. I don't know if you know Benji Madden. I'm not a punk rock band follower, but he's a guitarist for a very well-known punk rock band. That isn't actually awful. I think most punk rock bands are terrible. I love classic rock. Anyway, so I Googled it, and I've been listening to some of their stuff. They're called Good Charlotte. Now, why am I sharing this wedding? It's a very interesting wedding, because even though these two people, Cameron and Benji, are not Jewish, they got married under a chuppah. They had sheva brachot, yeah, which are the special seven traditional blessings that are recited under the chuppah at Jewish weddings. They broke a glass. I'm pretty sure Benji broke the glass at the end of the ceremony, remembering the destruction of the temple, which is the reason we break a glass.
He used to break the glass.
What's that?
So he used to break glass.
He took his guitar and smashed it. And they spent 30 minutes alone in a room right after the ceremony. What's that called? Anybody know? That's called yichud. There's a requirement that the couple be alone in a room. You guys remember this? For the first few minutes after their marriage. And I was like, why are they doing this? And not only that, but I've heard that many more fundamentalist Christians are now incorporating Jewish traditions into their wedding ceremony as well. And I find this fascinating. because of sometimes how difficult I often have convincing Jews to embrace different parts of classical Judaism. And sometimes people from outside of our faith seem to be drawn to things that we either take for granted or properly...
So they didn't suffer through the first part of it.
They didn't
go through the whole yeshiva process.
I think it has to do with the misunderstanding. And maybe even a failure on the part of us rabbis and teachers to be able to properly explain what mitzvot are about and what Jewish spirituality is trying to accomplish. Because I think the goal of Jewish spirituality is quite different than Buddhist spirituality. And what everybody tells me whenever they hear I'm going to talk about Buddhism and Judaism, they say, oh, make sure you tell them how much spirituality there is in Judaism, therefore they don't have to go to the Near Eastern religions to find it. We've got it here. Now that's true, and I'll touch on that in a little while, but it misses the point, because the goals are quite different. And I want to reference something I spoke about on Shabbat that is taken from this week's Torah reading, from last week's Torah reading. We just started the book of Exodus, Sefer Shemot. And in that parsha, some of you are familiar with the story, Moses is forced to flee Egypt, even though he was raised as a prince in the house of Pharaoh. And by the way, I went to see Night at the Museum. Has anybody ever seen those films?
Yes.
They're great. I went to, with my little guys, and there's this, I don't want to give it away, but there's a great scene in there with Ben Stiller, and they meet Pharaoh. You know, Pharaoh comes alive, and so when he meets Pharaoh, it's just one cute scene. He says, you know, please, he says, you must kiss my staff. You know, and like Ben Stiller's like, well, you know, and he was with this woman who's a Native American, you know, she really worships nature, and he's a Christian, and I'm half Irish and half Jewish. You know, so he's like, well, I am the son of Ra, the grandson of blah, 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 you will kiss my step. Well, you know, and he says, well, and then when he mentions he's half Jewish, his wife, Pharaoh's wife, says, oh, the Jewish people, we love them. They're lovely people. And he says back, well, we don't really have the same kind of feeling. You know, we enslaved, like tens of thousands of my ancestors, and we wandered for 40 years in the wilderness. And, you know, we have a whole dinner to talk about it once a year. It was so funny the way... Anyway, you should go see it. A cute little scene in the movie.
Don't see Exodus, though.
I didn't see it yet. Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I heard it was worse than Noah, so it's going to be pretty bad. So anyway, Moshe is forced to flee Egypt, and he settles in Midian. He gets married, and he becomes a shepherd. And he's tending to his flock, and he notices this bush burning. And he notices how the bush is burning, but it's somehow it's not being consumed. And out of this burning bush comes God's voice. And I'm going to read you the words, because I think this really sums it all up. Vayomer Moshe, and Moshe speaks really to himself. He's talking to himself. Asuruna, I'm going to turn the Ar'eh to Mareh HaGadol. Mareh is a thing, is like a sight. Lirot is to see. Mareh HaGadol is the great sight. This was like a sight, right? This would probably be an exhibit that people would come and pay to see, which is like a bush that's burning and not being consumed. So let me check it out. Madua lo yivar hasneh, he wondered. Why is the bush not burning? Vayar Hashem kisar lirot, and God sees that Moshe is turning, which is interesting, because what does that mean? God sees. God knows everything. God knew in advance that Moshe was going to be drawn to this. It's probably why he made it. So what is that? Vayikra elav Elokim mitoch hasneh. God speaks to Moses from the bush, from the midst of the bush. Vayomer, and he says, Moshe, Moshe. He repeats his name twice. Not sure where that is right now, but that's not the focus. Vayomer, hineni, he answers, here I am. Vayomer, and then God says to Moshe as he's walking closer to the bush, Al tikrav halom, don't come any closer. Shal na'alecha me'al raglecha. You remember this? What does he tell him to do? Take the shoes off your feet. Ki amakom asher tomed alav, because the place where you stand, admat kodesh, is holy ground. Now, why does God tell Moshe not to advance any closer? And why does he tell him to take off his shoes? What do you think?
What's the whole deal with the shoes?
Idolatry.
What does that mean?
They used to they used to walk onto grounds that were desecrated by idolatry, so I guess they took it off to clean their feet.
All right, so we see that reference earlier in the Bible in Genesis, right, when Abraham invites in the sort of the Arab the wanderers. He asks them to take off their shoes and wash their feet because they used to worship the dust of the ground. It was a form of idol worship. That could be.
Although humility.
Who else takes their shoes off, by the way?
Yes.
I don't know. In my house, I grew up in a German Jewish household, so we used to have to take our shoes off. My mother used to make us wear slippers because she was very superstitious. Because who else walks around barefoot?
Mourners.
You're not supposed to wear leather shoes during the week of mourning. She didn't want it to look like mourning, but she also didn't want you scuffing up the nice floors. when you can say Buddhists. Who else? Priests. The Jewish priests. The Kohanim performed the avoda, the service in the temple, barefoot. And we're going to see what that means in a minute. Now, Nachmanides, the great Kabbalist, tells us that God was telling Moses not to advance closer and not to get so close because he wasn't there yet. What does that mean, he wasn't there? Spiritually, he was not
ready.
He wasn't ready to be that close to the presence of the Almighty. Later on, when he's at Sinai, God tells him to come closer because he did develop. So it's a nice little lesson about developing ourselves spiritually. Nobody starts there, if you will. We're all building up to something greater. And the ground that he was on was holy. So therefore God tells Moshe to take off his shoes. Another rabbi, Rabbeinu Bachai, says the removal of the shoes was to remove the physical aspects of his existence so he can come totally in connection with prophecy, with the spiritual force of God, leave the physical in order to enter the spiritual. But the approach that I wanted to share with you is the exact opposite of that. And that is what I shared on Shabbat, Rav Hirsch. Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch was a great German Jewish philosopher, lived in the 1800s. And he said something very, very powerful that has everything to do with the difference between Judaism, the Jewish notion of spirituality, and the Buddhist or Near Eastern one. Rav Hirsch says that God telling Moshe not to get closer was saying not to keep going closer and closer to something which is so incomprehensible. The bush comes to symbolize that which makes no sense to the human mind. Right? It defied the laws of nature. The bush was on fire, yet it never was consumed. And there's a natural draw that we all have towards those kind of outer space, otherworldly phenomena. It's one of the most often asked questions I get as a rabbi, which is, what happens after you die? Not, Rabbi, what should I do while I'm alive? But what's going to be when I'm dead? And what is that thing with the resurrection of the dead? And what is the Messiah supposed to bring? And is there an afterlife? And there's this thing called resurrection, and our souls and our bodies are going to come back. We are so much more naturally drawn and attracted to the esoteric than we are the here and now. And that's what the burning bush, says Rav Hirsch, comes to symbolize. And God was telling Moshe, don't become obsessed with what doesn't make sense. Focus instead on what? What's underneath? What's Kodesh is holy? Admat Kodesh, the ground. What's the ground represent? Earth. The physical, finite world in which we were all created. First figure that out before starting to jump at the bush, if you will, and being attracted to that which is humanly incomprehensible. And let me read you what he said. Instead of attempting to understand a phenomena, this is Rav Hirsch writing, that is beyond your ken, contemplate the lofty destiny of the ground on which you are already standing and devote yourself to it with all of your heart. And this is really a classic teaching of Judaism. And it goes against our grain. Because when we think about being spiritual, the last thing we think about is this world. This world, to us, represents something too pedestrian and mundane and too filled with imperfection to really be such a special spiritual place. If we want to find spirituality, we have to somehow meditate ourselves into some other kind of realm to be able to achieve it. And Judaism says just the opposite, that true spirituality and holiness is really to be found in the here and now. And that's why Judaism is so mitzvah-centered. Because mitzvot, even though they technically mean commandments, people like to call them good deeds, because that's a little more politically correct way of saying it, because who wants to be told what to do? But a mitzvah is from the word Hebrew word tzav, which means command. So the 613 commandments, but they're not simply rules or rituals. They're things that were given to us to be able to use in the physical world to create true spirituality and holiness. And by the way, there is no such word in the Bible for spirituality. There is in the rabbis. It's called ruchnius. But there's no such word in the Torah. The only word in the Torah is kedusha, kadosh, which means to be holy. And holiness in Judaism is not what you do in a synagogue. Holiness is not even what you do on Yom Kippur. Holiness, because I always say, anyone could be holy in a shrine, or in a shul, or in a church, when you're on your best behavior. The question is, can you make holy something which otherwise is physical or mundane? That is the test of whether a person is truly holy or not. And so I gave on Shabbat some examples that I'd like to share with you. What are examples, real life examples, of how we make the physical world a holy place? And our own physical lives holy, as opposed to abandoning the physical world, trying to meditate ourselves into some spiritual realm, so that we can kind of escape this reality, which is just like, fine, this is the world, I have to kind of get a job and, you know, do all these physical things because that's who I was created. But I'm really just a soul, and the soul needs to go beyond. So what are some of the things we do?
Use your physical existence for someone else's metaphysical benefit.
Hmm.
How
would you do that? That sounds quite lofty of a goal. But what, bring it down to earth, because that's really... What's that?
I guess, you know, essentially going to visit, you know, another, like you're basically...
Visiting someone who is in mourning, and really, yeah?
By using your physical time and your presence to think,
yes,
how to act, that changes someone else's life.
Think how to act, or...
Think and act in a way that changes somebody else's life. That where they actually feel differently.
I just did it right now. I was thirsty, I took some wine, I made a blessing. What was that?
A brachot.
Why? Why do we make a blessing? What was the point? I'm just drinking, I was thirsty, and I wanted a little alcohol, loosen up. I make a blessing, what does that do? I just mumbled a few words. It shows I'm honoring God. What else does it... what are the words, actually? I said, Baruch Atah Hashem, blessed are you, God. Elokeinu Melech Olam, Borei Pri HaGefen. I'm just acknowledging that God's the source. So what did that accomplish?
Awareness.
It made me aware as I was eating, as I was consuming something of God. And in a sense, I've just... I mean, you just said it a moment ago in terms of your thought processes, but relating it somehow to the physical daily activities. So when you... If someone decides to observe the laws of kashrut and they check for a label, on a, you know, kosher label, or they recite a blessing before they drink or eat something, that's a regular activity that could just remain as a regular physical mundane activity. Animals get hungry, they eat too. What we're supposed to do is before we eat, we're supposed to try to somehow use this to somehow connect spiritually. What are other examples of this besides a blessing, let's say? We're observing the laws of kashrut.
Keeping Shabbat.
How does Shabbat? How is that?
Exactly the same way.
Well, I would say actually Shabbat is a good example of like the flip of this, which is we use physical things on Shabbat to connect spiritually. How? What do we do? How do you actually keep Shabbat? What's one of the first things you do to bring it in?
Light candles.
You light a candle, right? What else?
Well, you refrain from doing.
You refrain from certain physical activities, okay, which symbolize our belief that
we're not Yom Kippur, right? It would be the same.
The full creator, also on Yom Kippur, but for different reasons. But what else are you doing positively on Shabbat that involves the physical? There's a mitzvah to do what on Shabbos?
Eat.
How many meals on Shabbos is he supposed to have? He's supposed to have Sudash Lishit, 3 meals. It's a lot of food. What else is he supposed to eat, do on Shabbos?
Right.
What's that?
Fresh.
Okay, each of the meals have to have bread and wine. Why specifically wine? Because wine is a physical thing that can help alter our state of consciousness. Also, what else do we do on Shabbat physically?
Pray.
Okay, well, I want to stay away from prayer because prayer is like the paradigmatic example of pure spirituality, which I'll come back to soon. What else?
We dress
physically in a certain way and differently. We sing songs. Yeah, you're supposed to try to sing on Shabbat because what happens when you sing? What happens to you? How does that affect you? It affects us tremendously. Okay, some people take naps because, you know, I mean, people don't keep Shabbos. Always wonder why a grown adult would take a nap in the middle of a Saturday afternoon. And then when you start eating 3 meals and drinking all that wine, you realize why you're sleeping by the end of lunch. You know, the Shabbos table I had growing up, there was a very fine line between the end of the meal and the nap. So all these kinds of things. So Shabbos is a very good example. Now, I was going to give another example. What about your work? What's that? Oh, good. What does family purity laws do?
You're adding a spiritual element to...
One of the other expressions of physicality. In fact, Maimonides, the great philosopher, put two areas of Jewish law in one book he called the Book of Holiness. And he didn't put the laws of Yom Kippur in there. He didn't put the laws of Tefillin or Shabbat. What areas of halakha did Maimonides characterize under the book he called the Book of Holiness? The laws of Torah to Mishpacha, the laws of family purity, right, which are supposed to bring holiness into the sexual realm, and the laws of Kashrut, food and sex. Now, I'll tell you something else really fascinating, and I said this on Shabbat as well. Dayan Grunfeld, who was a British Jewish legal expert, wrote that 3 out of the 4 sections of the Shulchan Aruch, has anyone heard of the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law? It's authored in the 1500s by Rav Yosef Cairo. 3 out of the 4 sections. I'm going to read them to you. 1, Choshen Mishpat. What's in Choshen Mishpat? Laws of torts, if anybody went to law school here, assault, battery, torts, that whole deal. Laws of property, commercial dealings, financial transactions. That's all of Choshen Mishpat. 2, Yoredeah is the second section of the Shulchan Aruch. Yoredeah, you have to learn to be a rabbi. It deals with laws of kashrut, keeping kosher. Evan I Ezra, laws of marriage and divorce. Have I said anything of pure spirituality? That's holiness. Is taking those halachot, taratz mishpacha, kashrut, and putting them into the physical plane. So if I'm at work, and I know that I'm... You know, if I say something nasty about this other person, I'm not trying to defame him, I just want to get ahead. But I know that according to the laws of Lashon Hara, I'm not supposed to say anything negative, even though it could be helpful to me, and even though it's true. And I don't do it. Or I don't cheat. Or I declare all of my earnings on my tax forms this year. What is that? That in Judaism is called Kedusha. Holiness isn't going up to some mountain and meditating and into some other realm. Holiness is here and now. It's not about escaping the reality, it's about infusing holiness and spirituality into the reality. And I would say that is the fundamental difference between the Jewish notion of spirituality and the Buddhist and other Eastern religions. Now, having said that, did you have a question?
No, I
please.
Was thinking that, like, I feel like in the same way that some Buddhists might go to Thailand or something and go on top of a mountain and feel peaceful and meditate, like Jews go to Israel.
Yeah.
And get that feeling.
Correct.
But like, it is difficult to get that on a daily basis here. So like, how do you get to that point?
So what's your name?
Carly,
it's a good point. I think we do. I think a lot of people do go to Israel to feel that spiritual connection that maybe a Buddhist would travel to Thailand to have. I think that's accurate. And a lot of people are on a very spiritual high, and it's a big low when they come back. So we believe God is anywhere, and you don't have to be in a certain place. But it's like the gym. You can work out at home, but it's much more conducive to work out in a gym. So that's why we tell people to come to synagogue. You could pray alone, but if you're praying around other people working out, and there's like a whole kind of pump-up feel in the room, it's going to be more conducive. So we really just encourage people to be connected. That's really why MGE, I always give this speech when I come back from our trip to Israel every summer, you know, stay connected, be around other people searching for this as well, because it'll never be like it's over there. It won't. It's just very special there, and there's something mystical in the air. But God is everywhere. And you just need to sort of search out the right environments in which to feel Him or His presence a bit more. But, you know, listen, there are people who've told me that, like, Rabbi, I couldn't make it to synagogue. You know, I decided to pray at home. And I tell you, I connected in a more powerful way sometimes when you're alone. But, and I'm going to use this, if it's okay, as a way of just segueing. I don't mean to say that trying to escape the physical finite world is not a Jewish value at all. And in this sense, Judaism does share Buddhists, you know, desire and attempt to transcend the physical finite world. We pray three times a day. And I mentioned this on Shabbat. How do we start our silent devotion? We do a little Jewish choreography. We take three steps back and then three steps forward. And we do that to concretize this idea that we're leaving the physical realm and we're entering the spiritual realm. We're supposed to try to do that. The Kabbalists talk about this thing called Hitzbodedut, which means solitude and meditation. And a lot of this, Arye Kaplan, if you want to read a great book, he wrote a book called A Jewish Meditation, which is all about tefillah, prayer. And he speaks about how Buddhism and other Near Eastern religions developed, and he believes that they actually developed based on some of the Kabbalistic meditations that Judaism already had. So there's no question that there are similarities. But I would say that the fundamental difference is to try to bring spirituality into this world as opposed to trying to escape the physical world in order to find it. That's much more challenging, though. It's much more challenging to try to go into your office place, into your kitchen, into the bedroom, into the regular physical world and bring God into it. It's much simpler. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's easier to try to just get away from the whole thing and be spiritual. The problem with that is that you're living in two worlds. You're living in two worlds. And that means you're spiritual over here, and then over here you're like, who knows? You know, I'll tell you the absolute extreme of this. And that is the opening scene. I'm a Godfather movie lover, if anybody watched The Godfather. So do you know the opening scene for The Godfather? Michael Corleone, the Godfather, is at his grandson's christening. And it's like this heavy church music, and you're watching the baby, like, being baptized. And they're, like, showing the whole family, and they're showing he's, like, crossing himself. He's doing, like, all the rituals in church. And then they show, like, him the next day beating somebody up to a pulp. And then they go back to the church, and he's doing something else religious. And they show him the next day he's shooting three other people. And the next day he's, like, extorting some guy, and he's whacking off there. He's, you know, the wife is getting killed, and it's, like, terrible. And they try to show this terrible hypocrisy. Now, this is an extreme example. I'm not saying Christians do this, and I'm not saying Buddhists do this. I'm saying what it ultimately leads to is a bifurcation. It might make us a little more peaceful by doing much more meditating, but it's not going to really tell us how to infuse the workplace with spirituality. It's not going to tell us how to infuse one's sexual relationship between husband and wife with spirituality, or how to eat in a more spiritual way. And that's what mitzvot are really all about. And we forget that, because we just think they're things you have to do, and that's what Jewish Jews do. And if you're a traditional Jew, you do it, and if you're not, you don't. And then we'll pay homage to it when we have a ceremony, we'll show up a couple times a year on Yom Kippur at the Seder, and we'll do the Jewish ceremonies. But we don't realize that the real Judaism is not in shul. It's not even around the Seder table. It's in the workplace, and it is in everyday life. That's the opportunity for true sanctity and holiness, as far as Judaism is concerned. So maybe that's another way of answering your question, which is, if you're not feeling it so much, here in America, which is even more physical, you know, and more material, if you will. It is. Israel's got a certain spirituality. It depends where you go in Israel, too, obviously. But in a sense, there's more opportunity for spirituality, therefore, in the diaspora. There's more need for it, for us to introduce that into the secular world. And if you study the great Kabbalists, there's really no difference between the secular and the spiritual. The secular is just waiting to be elevated. And it's not an opposing force. It's a force that, it's a vessel that's supposed to somehow be elevated through the mitzvot. And that's why most of the mitzvot don't deal with the pure spiritual. That's why, who mentioned prayer?
Oh.
Somebody mentioned prayer. I didn't want to deal with prayer because prayer is the pure spiritual. Everybody's spiritual when they pray. But can you take the themes of prayer and bring them into your real life? So we're not living this bifurcated world of like, yeah, today I'm a holy guy because it's Shabbos, and today it's Tuesday, so I'm not. You know what I mean? That's the goal. That's the goal. But I also agree, you need spurts of spirituality, and Israel is a great way to find that. No question. Yes, Miriam, please. Right, and I think that, just to follow up on that, was an excellent point. I think that the ultimate goal is to find true spiritual, meditative, contemplative tranquility through the application of the mitzvot to the physical daily activities that we all have. That's the goal. That's why, according to Nachmanides, the greatest spiritual level you could ever attain is not the world to come. What's the world to come? We had a class on this a long time ago. I don't know if any of you were here. The world to come is when the body dies, the soul moves on to another world. An all spiritual world. There's no body. There's no body. Okay? The resurrection of the dead is when the body and the soul come back together. And that, according to Nachmanides, is the highest eschatological phase possible. Because the goal is not simply to be spiritual without the body. The goal is to somehow bring the body into spirituality. And that, as I say, that's much more challenging. We have a loftier goal to achieve. Now, again, don't misunderstand me, and I think this is where Buddhism and Judaism are share a lot, which is there is a goal to spend some time to remove ourselves from the physical realm and not just simply be encased in materialism and physicality. And that's why we pray three times a day. And that's why meditation, or even when I study, I try to spend every day some period of time studying for myself. And I find that to be a very spiritual and meditative kind of thing, even though it's cognitive and intellectual at the same time. But the goal ultimately is not to create a personality that is so removed from the world that he or she is just, you know, this lofty saint that, oh, they're not in this world anymore. That's not the goal. And you will see also, we're going to talk a little more in the next class about the difference between Judaism and Christianity. It's got a parallel there. Because we like to think of the holier people are the ones who have no sex, who don't eat anything, they're on a mountain somewhere meditating and disconnecting from the physical realm. Those are the holiest people. Those are not our models and role models if you look at the Torah. Our role models in the Torah are people who fought wars. I mean, not, we never glorified war in defense, and entered into business transactions, had families, and lived normal lives. But they were elevated spiritual lives. And that's much more difficult to achieve, I think. Yes?
And so then when it's just spirit, you can't do anything, right? Isn't that the problem? That without the body, how do you accomplish something meaningful?
So that, yeah.
Because that seems to be the rush I would get, is if you feel like you did something. So
my son showed me something very beautiful. Shuki's here, maybe you've seen something like this about, like a person who is deaf. No. Person who is lame and a person who is blind, and how they needed each other, because the person who couldn't physically walk needed the person who could walk to take him to the different places, but that other person needed the sight to show him which way to go. And that was like the analogy between the body and the soul. Like the soul knows what to do, but it can't do it without the body. Now you'll say, well, why didn't God just create us as souls? But he didn't. And I personally cannot believe that we were placed in this world as physical, you know, beings just to negate the physicality. That's the goal of life, to make believe that the part of us that's physical isn't. Now, if that was the case, then the Torah would not simply restrict sexuality, it would say it was forbidden altogether, which is not the case.
That's from the allegory of the cave. That feels like Plato, right? Like they're in the cave, they hear a voice, they can't see what's going on beyond that.
Right.
That's where you took that from, I think.
So maybe that's where it's from originally. But the body and the soul are supposed to work in tandem. The question is, who's calling the shots? Is it the body or is it the soul?
Yeah, most importantly, the point about being grounded, it's essential that a lot of people who don't have any foundation, they go from an unstable isotope to another unstable isotope. You have Israelis who serve in the military, who don't have a solid foundation, and then they go to a spiritual
solid,
foundation
in educationally.
Not just education, just who they are. They feel they've seen life, and they've seen death,
right,
and they feel confused, and then they go to another place where, you know, it's very easy to go from one unstable place to another unstable place. A lot of reasons why people go to, you know, go into dangerous situations, they need a spiritual belonging, but at the same time, without that foundation, they can be pushed around.
No, but it actually makes a lot of sense why someone who at such a young age is exposed to so much blood would be drawn to something like Buddhism, which is a very, very beautiful, peaceful, you know, get away from the physical. Here, Judaism is saying, no, don't leave the physical. Here's just a way of approaching it. You know, someone who's been exposed to the extreme physical, the taking of human life, you know, albeit legitimately for self-defense, would maybe desire something that was completely different and just get away from the whole physical. I don't want anything to do with it anymore.
Which the Rambam would agree to, right?
I'm sorry?
The Rambam would agree, right? The opposite extreme.
I don't know if I would make such a sweeping statement, right, necessarily. Any other comments? Yes, please.
I just had a quick, I've been reading a lot of Jewish textbook lately. I just find it so amazing that I was in your class, they're always so inspirational. And we make up such a small population as Jewish people, yet we have such a big presence. It's so amazing to me, you know, like...
It is amazing.
It's
and
so amazing, it really is.
It's amazing, and I would argue that maybe,
one of the reasons why Jews keep trying to make the world a better place, and I'm generalizing, not everybody, but the Nobel Peace Prize, as you've all heard the statistics, I'm sure, are way out of whack with our tiny... I was watching a debate between Lord Jonathan Sacks and Richard Dawkins, who's a famous atheist, and he was trying to demonstrate how small of a percentage Jews were in England and how many of the Nobel Prizes were won even just there. And it's not just brains and intelligence. You know? Ooh. That's pretty cool. You see how it's connected to the physical world? The pizza box. But we try maybe harder than anyone else. And the question is why? Why do Jews try so hard to make a difference in a world that isn't always so friendly and kind? I don't know if you saw, by the way, we should let this class go by without just acknowledging. I went last night to... did anyone see just the big march today in France? Netanyahu was there, and many other world leaders were there as well. But, you know, if anyone should have been jaded and been given, quote-unquote, a justification for sort of pulling out from the physical world and saying, I had enough, you know, I'll make the world better when they stop trying to kill me, it would be the Jew. But we just keep coming back. We just keep... Do you know what Hitler used to call science? He used to call it Jewish science. Because Einstein wasn't just one really well-known Jewish scientist. Most of Germany's scientists who were the leading scientists in the world in the 1930s were mostly German. Yeah, afterwards to fight the communists. We're Jews. Now, is it just because we're smart? You know, okay, we're well-educated. You know, maybe that breeds something. I don't know. I think it's because we're motivated to make the world a better place, because that was our mission, always, was to take the Torah and bring it into the world. And even if it's Sigmund Freud or Albert Einstein, it's not Torah itself. These still were Jewish people inspired by some kind of legacy of tikkun olam, which means rectifying the world. And that's the ultimate goal of mitzvot. They're not just, if I can leave you with one thought tonight, they're not just rules and obligations. They're divine methodologies to make the world a holier and better place. And that is where true kedushah, sanctity and holiness can be found. And that's how I would articulate the core difference between Judaism and Buddhism and some of the other more Eastern faith systems. Not to degrade or say anything negative. I think it's great when anybody tries to become more spiritually connected, but not at the expense of or retreating from the physical world. We have another program in a few minutes, so I want to leave some time for Shuki. Please stick around for some physical food that you can enjoy, cold pizza, and you can make a blessing. Anybody know the blessing on a slice of pizza?
Mizonos.
Right, so you could do it. Mizonos is fine. Baruch Atah, I'll just say it with you if you want to do it. It's an opportunity to practice what we've preached tonight. It's Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Olam Borei Mine Mizonot, and there's some incredibly healthy soda and water, and then Shuki's got his Shuki Cafe Connect tonight.
Yes, sir.
All right. If anybody's interested in sticking around for that, what are you going to be talking about later?
Sushi. All right, we're going to be talking about Noah and the Flood, the movie series.
Awesome.
This week, talking about Noah. Next week, talking about God the King.
Okay. Thank you all for coming, everyone. It's a pleasure.
What's going on? Just before anybody goes out, we have next week, we're doing a special...